My name is Hans Spalteholz, and we're doing a series on the so-called festival scrolls in the Old Testament. And today, the story that we'll be looking at is the festival scroll called Ruth. I'd like to say a few words of introduction to that, and then suggest some directions in which our story will be taking us. First, just a few words of introduction. This week, we'll only be doing two of the festival scrolls, namely Ruth, which in the observant Jewish families and synagogues is read on Pentecost every year. And we will also do Lamentations, I think, Wednesday at this time, which is a very interesting book read once a year in the Jewish community on the 9th of Av. That's usually sometime in August, and it's when they commemorate the destruction of Jerusalem and now also commemorate Holocaust, the destruction of 6 million Jews. So there are many reasons why that will be of intense interest to us. The other three, Song of Solomon, which is read on Passover, on the eighth day of the celebration, Ecclesiastes, which is read in the Feast of Tabernacles, the fall harvest, and Esther, which is read at the Feast of Purim, that's in February, March, we read a week ago or so, and so they're on tapes, I believe. We won't have time to get to them this week. Now that briefly is a word about just the festival scrolls as such. You may ask, why on earth are you taking such obscure books? And one of the reasons I'm taking them is just because they are so obscure, in quotation marks. I won't be able to develop this too fully, but many of them are what I'd like to call books on the margin of the canon. Three of them almost didn't make it into the Old Testament. At least there was some debate whether they really should be in the Old Testament among the Jewish rabbis who debated these matters. And I guess the symbol for the closing of the canon in 90 AD is the time where we have records of some of these debates. You may well guess which they were. For example, Ecclesiastes, which is so terribly pessimistic. Song of Solomon, which, like Ecclesiastes, does not even mention the name of God. And the Song of Solomon, if you take it literally, is a rather marvelously beautiful but also sensuous story of, or a poem of the love between a man and a woman. And then finally, Esther, which is also... No, excuse me, Ecclesiastes mentions the name of God, but Esther does not mention the name of God and has some interesting motifs, a strong motif perhaps of revenge. And yet those books, just because they're on the margin, and I won't be able to go into full detail about this, do help point us to the center of Scripture and also in a way define its limits. In any case, this week we'll be looking at Ruth and we'll be looking at Lamentations. Now, I'd like to point ahead to where I hope eventually we'll be going. In a sense, let's say it's just a story, an interesting story, a little pastoral idyll, a lovely story in the midst of the time of the judges, which was a very chaotic time. And if you're ever reading through the whole Bible, when you get to Ruth, you'll say, ah, what a relief. So it is like a little pause that refreshes, a little moment of rest between all sorts of important things. And hence, we may tend to, let's say, trivialize the story or say, well, it's just a story or it's nice for a day at Holden. However... One commentator has said it takes us to things that are very at the very heart of Scripture. And I'd like to suggest four areas where, after we've looked at the story a little bit, I think we'll be coming out. One is, what does it say about how God works in human life? And the second is, does it say anything about a lifestyle? If any of you have heard John Schramm's lecture, Think With, And I think your key word, John, is sufficiency. Is there a think with here, a basic presupposition of sufficiency? A third thing that we will look at briefly will be the matter of covenant and law. The word covenant, a very important word in the Old Testament, is never mentioned. And yet I wonder if the story is not going to take on rich meaning in the covenant context, and are there clues in the story which point us that way? And then the very last is the most intriguing of all, perhaps in view of our theme this year, namely singing or sing the Lord's song. The only song, in a sense, that's being sung in the first chapter is one of complaint. Naomi is complaining to God. She is bitter about what God has dished out to her. And yet, at the end of the story, I think there's an incredible celebration, you know, a singing of the Lord's song. Okay, well, now that gives you some idea of some of the directions that I hope we'll go to. But you don't just jump from story to those matters. So, we've had a chance to read through the story together. We've looked at it a little bit, and I'd like to throw out two thought questions for you and then let you break up in small groups for about 4 or 5 minutes and discuss any part of the story that you would like, but maybe with the thought question in mind. The first thought question is as follows. What kind of a piece of writing do we have here? Is this just plain history? You know, like the history books in the scripture? Or is it a artistically crafted story? And what do you make of that question? Okay, and then the other question that I'd like you to think about a little bit is how does this story, though it seems to be a marginal story, perhaps get at the heart of some of the most important things that make up the story of God's people in the Old Testament, and perhaps even in the New? Now, I know many of you will have comments on these matters, and I think what I'd like to have you do is to break up into just very small groups of maybe 3, at the most 4, to have a chance to talk with one another about this. Okay. Might put them back in terms of the 2 questions I asked, though they aren't necessarily the only ones to ask, namely, is it just a plain historical record like what we may consider the other history books in the Bible, or is it a carefully crafted story? And what do you make of that question? And secondly, what do you think are some of the key issues in the story? How does it get at the heart of things in Scripture, even though it is just a little idyll, a little lovely story between much greater historical narrative of much greater historical import? I'd like to invite any of you to jump in with questions or comments. Maybe you want to start somewhere else, some things that troubled you about the story.
We'll start on your question. We more or less agreed that it was a very carefully crafted idol, and I commented that I thought it was the quality of the idols of the king. And from this, we sort of jumped to the tail end, where the genealogy comes in that you find at the beginning of Matthew also. And this brought up the importance of women in the Jewish faith. And the exception here that it worked in the form of Ruth. Here is Ruth, a non-Jew, in the line of genealogy of Christ, which one of the things that perhaps may have made him unacceptable to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, etc. There's a break. She was not a Jew or Jewish.
Does Matthew do that again?
He traces it.
Does he do it with another woman? the same thing.
Tamar.
Rahab the harlot.
Yeah.
Yes, a very interesting two women that Matthew obviously deliberately singles out. One commentator has suggested that the whole point of this story of Ruth is to show what kind of pious ancestors David and then in turn Jesus Christ had. And that was one of the famous last century commentators, Kyle and Delitzsch, if you've heard the name, used that as his basic point of the story. Now, today people have put different emphases on it. In fact, some commentators have said that that addition of the genealogy is a late addition. I think nearly everyone agrees that editors put that on later on, and feel some have said it spoils a good story. And others have had other theories about what its implications are. Okay, so we certainly see it as, in a way, an early preparation for Christmas, if you want to take it very directly as being picked up by Matthew in the genealogy that leads up to Christ. There may be lots of other ways, though, that it is early preparation for Christmas beyond just the immediate tracing of a bloodline and the remarkable placing of a Moabitess woman into the genealogy of Christ, a man for all nations. Any other comments or observations or interesting points? Tim?
I was wondering, there's a lot of things happening that aren't understandable because it's their culture. I was wondering if maybe you could explain, you know, what the significance is of like her coming in and laying at his, the man's feet. And
let's start with that one. Does it create any kind of suspense in your minds when she comes in at midnight? I mean, at earlier, and he wakes up at midnight and so on, and then uncovers his feet and says what she says to him. Does that create any suspense in your mind?
Suspense or premarital sex?
Yeah, that certainly is the suspicion. What's going on here? Right? Is this some hanky panky? As the world turns, all right. And if it isn't, why is it said in such explicitly sexual terms? As you probably know, in Leviticus, there's a passage which says in most uncompromising terms that the son who uncovers the skirt of his father, I think it is, must be stoned to death. In other words, that means if a son has incest with his mother, he is guilty for stoning. So uncovering the skirt implies sexual relations. That's not all it implies, though. And there's a very, very interesting pun in the Hebrew, which we'll have to get to in a minute. Was that, Marty,
that
what you were going to...
That was going to ask that, John.
Yeah.
Feet, right?
No.
Is Hebrew feet? I thought it's ambiguous.
The corner of the skirt also means, anybody know?
Wings,
yeah. Now let's look at Ruth chapter 2, verse 12. This is an expression on the part of Boaz, and it's a kind of an invocation, a prayer to God. The Lord recompense you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel. And now look how he's described, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. If we wanted to be consistent in our translation, we'd have to say, under whose, skirt corner you have taken refuge. Now, unfortunately, we don't have that come through in our translation. So here it probably means simply the formal request on the part of Ruth that Boaz, the near of kinsman, do the duties of a kinsman. And maybe that's another thing that we have to explain briefly. There was an ancient law called the Levirate law. And that law was that if a woman had no children and her husband died, then the brother of the husband had the obligation to see to it that the family line would be carried on. And this was combined, although it is not done so in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, with another idea, and that is that a kinsman has a responsibility to buy the property of another kinsman who is in a state of poverty. So that the property would stay within the family. If he is unable to do that in the year of Jubilee, it is returned again to the family. Now, these two are combined in this story, and Naomi suggests to Ruth that Ruth go to Boaz and ask Boaz to do the duty of a kinsman, a goel, a redeemer. And so, in effect, when she says what she says, it sounds like a proposal for marriage. And in fact, that's what it is.
The question I was going to ask before, feet, I thought is an ambiguous word, also means genitals.
Yes.
Can't in Hebrew.
Yes, it can. And so the whole story has, most people, probably, could it have a, let me put it in the form of a question, a deliberate double entendre? Namely, that she puts herself into, let's say, an ambiguous situation, a temptation situation, a situation of risk. And maybe that's the way life sometimes is. And how are they going to manage this? Boaz says to her, you know, everyone knows you are a woman of high worth and high repute. And so it would certainly be... And I guess we must, the story implies that these people are of highest integrity, and it's not that they say one thing and do another. So that would mean that they act indeed honorably here and do not have premarital relations. But they certainly are in an ambiguous situation. And obviously, if people saw her leaving at, say, 6 in the morning, what would the townsfolk think? Obviously. So he says, you better leave before sunup and get home so no one sees you. I think those are perhaps the two most intriguing parts of background information for the story, though there may be some other things too that you have questions about. And I'm not the absolute expert on any of these, but some of them I've looked into and they have fascinated me, and hence I'm happy to share that with you. But maybe you have some thing to share or questions to ask. Yes.
Boaz went to another man at the gate there and asked if he would redeem the land.
Yes, he goes to another kinsman who's a nearer kinsman. And the nearer kinsman is told, there's some land for you. And he's willing to put down the money and to do what he ought to do. When does he back away? Married. Does anyone know why he backs away then?
I cannot redeem it for myself lest I impair my own inheritance.
Yes, the problem is the impairing of his own inheritance. If Ruth does have a son, then where will the property go? To Ruth's son, and he can't afford to do that. I mean, it would be a distinct loss. The other way around, he would be involved in getting the produce of the property for the time allotted until the year of Jubilee. But this way, he would surely lose the property completely.
Couldn't make enough money at the time.
Yeah. Right. In other words, he's willing to go a little bit out of the way, but there's a certain point where he says, now, that's expecting a little bit too much. It wouldn't be that much of a profit involved for me. This is what's at stake here.
Why was the comment made that Ruth was of more value to Naomi than the 7 sons in light of the way the Jews valued the sons? That they said that she is of more worth than 7 sons.
Does anyone want to address that question? Why is Ruth more of worth than 7 sons?
Because
She's the one that made it possible for the family line to be continued.
Okay, that's a good pragmatic reason. In the long run, maybe there will be as many as 7 sons and even more. Anything else? It's a high compliment, isn't it?
Her love and loyalty to man?
Yes, I think that's the center of it, this marvelous fidelity which is expressed in that passage, which is often used in marriage ceremonies, isn't it? Whithersoever, to use a King James, thou goest, I will go, and whithersoever thou lodgest, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. So this tremendous fidelity, even though there were not offspring at the time, or at least at first. Anything else you want to comment on, or that intrigues you?
Do you think that Boaz was tricked into this, or that he felt tricked into it, and did it only as a duty?
Let me push it even a little harder. When we read this in my literature classes, where I came across it, studying a lot of literature, secular literature, and they put in the story of Ruth, my students, many of them said, why, she's just a meddling mother-in-law. And I think that pushes it even harder. So, the mother-in-law seems to be meddling and scheming. Does she scheme?
I would say she's a wise helper.
Does she plan ahead? Does she give her daughter-in-law explicit advice? Yes. She knows whom she's dealing with. With whom is she dealing? Boaz. Does she know Boaz?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, how old is Boaz?
He's an old man.
He's an old man. Does an old bachelor need prompting? What else do we know about him as a person? How about that scene with the reapers and with his overseer? He's generous, kind. How is he economically?
Well off.
He's well off. That means something about his character, doesn't it? He's been a hard worker. He's been thrifty, but he hasn't married.
Why?
Do we know? Are there any clues why?
No. He looks like a very good catch.
Yeah. There we go again. Yes. Question or comment?
Perhaps he was waiting for the right woman, the woman, the hard worker, and he noticed Ruth as a hard worker, and he noticed that she really took care of the mother-in-law and loved the mother-in-law greatly, and perhaps that is what he was looking for.
Was he doing much taking of the initiative?
No.
Yes? No?
Oh, that's right. He was, put some more wheat on the floor or whatever.
When did he do that? Before her proposal of marriage to him or after?
Before.
Mm-hmm. She got all this extra grain and easy pickings and so on.
Do you think that his early gift was a little hint that he had marital interests in her? Could there be another motive? Tim, excuse me.
Naomi might have noticed this interest. I mean, she could see that there was, maybe she saw the hint that there was extra meanings or whatever, and then, kind of picked up on it and pushed her.
She came home with extra
daughter-in-law. Encouraged her daughter-in-law.
How can we preserve Naomi from being terribly scheming here by finding another motive, at least for the moment, for Boaz's giving generously to her? And Gerda? He's intrigued by her. Has he heard of her?
Yes.
Yes, right. Okay. And he knows the kindness that she has done to Naomi. He certainly goes out of the way to give her extra favors, doesn't he?
He also tests her a bit with the younger.
Yes, and he later on compliments her for the fact that even though there were younger men around whom she could be attracted to, she did not do that. By the way, that tells us there's quite an age gap between them, because she is obviously a younger woman. Marty?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, you know, there is a, we would call her, you know, manipulative and scheming today.
I think we would.
Because there are some other choices open for how a woman is to get power today. In a patriarchal society, there are no other choices on how one is to get and use power. And I think you have to look at the Oriental culture or, you know, strongly patriarchal cultures where there are no choices of how to get and use power to find similar examples. And I think it's the story is told as an example of someone who is terribly resourceful and finds a way to obtain some power for herself.
I would say not for herself. I think that Ruth was faithful to Naomi and followed her, and Naomi is now being faithful to Ruth.
Well, okay, for both of them. Yeah.
That's the only way she could care for her or be, you know, good to her, was to get her into the system, and the system was through men.
Yes.
It says a couple times that, the story makes it obvious that Ruth is in danger of being molested. She's a young, unprotected woman, and Naomi cares about her, and that's a very precarious way to live. There would have been no kinsman, literally, that anyone would have to answer to. They were poor and defenseless, and if Naomi loved her daughter-in-law, she wouldn't want her to live in that continual risk, and that danger of being molested is mentioned a couple times. So I think that's a very generous motive in part for wanting her to have a protector in addition, let alone being wealthy or whatever.
Okay, so she is concerned perhaps for her her personal safety and certainly more broadly for her security in the long range sense of once Naomi dies, then where will Ruth be? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are so many different things that come up in the cultural differences, too, in this judgment of Boaz as being a trustworthy person. The fact that he was rich meant that he was, in the eyes of God, a good man, which would be even more than we do it. And we have so much of it, as you were suggesting in the other part. Changing culture and understanding this is extremely important.
Yes, the cultural background, is of great importance, and in a sense we may see, as we do in many stories, God's blessing as people are wealthy. But are there some totally inexplicable misfortunes that happen in the story?
Yes.
Yes, right? The famine in the beginning, and they have to leave the land. This has happened in other times. And then, of course, the death of Naomi's husband, and then the death of her two sons.
But at the same time, that becomes a different thing because they were not Jews, too. Culturally, the whole thing, the accident could happen a little bit easier than if it were a Jew. And still, God's blessing would be there.
Now, who was not a Jew? Isn't Naomi's husband a Jew?
Yeah, well, I mean, she was not a Jew at that time. But this was not accepted. This could be understood in that way, because it was the Jew that had the cultural tie.
I'm not sure that I follow that, because
not the Naomi, but we mean Ruth was not a Jew.
Ruth was not a Jew. Yes.
So that could be easily understood. Mm-hmm. And the Jews were in a foreign country, and therefore it wouldn't necessarily apply that. I mean, culturally, I think that's extremely important to see all of the way through.
Okay, I guess what I'm a little bit concerned about is it may look like a rewards, you live right and God rewards you. And I think that the story suggests there are other dimensions which I'd like to push us toward a little bit beyond that. Is it just self-evident that people are nice to each other when they're people of Israel? From the story.
No.
Are there some people who act as foils to the unusual behavior of Ruth and of Boaz?
Yes.
How about Orpah? How is she, in a way, a foil to her sister? She went, well, the most obvious thing is she went back home. Now, we're told about her that she did mercy. She did chesed for her. The two sisters did chesed for Naomi. However, later on, when Boaz compliments Ruth, he says, "You have done two deeds of chesed," the Hebrew word for loving kindness, that great word for God's character. He says to Ruth, "You have done two deeds of chesed." So in a sense, she has gone the extra mile. Now, what about Boaz? Do you see a similar pattern for him? What about his kinsman? Isn't that another case where the kinsman is willing to go to a certain point, but then Boaz is going to go the extra way? Yes, he is willing to both pay and to take this young girl as his, and mind you, a Moabitess, as his wife. If he really was anxious to marry, he perhaps could have married some time ago. So I think the implication might be that he is going the extra step. What about in the gleaning? Does he show generosity there beyond the accepted?
Yeah, pulling out some of the good grain out of the sheep.
Yes, even pulling out good grain and having her glean where?
The best part of the field.
Yes. And giving her permission in the first place, and then in addition to that, letting her eat bread and wine. Isn't that an interesting moment? And then she got so much food, she had more than enough for herself, and what did she do with the extra? Took it home. Isn't there a remarkable pattern here of going the extra mile in sharing the goods of the earth with those in need? Mm-hmm. So it's a rich story in terms of this kind of sharing, caring, mutual concern. And I think that has tremendous ramifications for a lot of the things that are being discussed here at Holden when we look about an alternative lifestyle. Maybe we can explore that further or come back to that or use this as illustrative material. Any other comments or questions as we go along through the story? And then I'd like, we're moving to some of the main insights, I think, of the story as we are looking at it and asking questions about it.
Just a question about gleaning. Is it the actual harvesting or taking the grain, or is it picking up the leftovers?
It's picking up the leftovers. The harvesters go through, and then there are a certain amount of kernels, and then there's a law in Deuteronomy which indicates that people should leave the pieces of wheat that have fallen down and so on the ground rather than picking up every last piece. Now, we in a modern American technology are much more efficient than that. We pick up every last kernel of corn, but not here. There's supposed to be some left over for the poor. And the reason probably why she comes and asks for permission is that many landowners did not follow that law. Yes. Okay, so that the gleaning is quite significant, and I think is, well, enough said. Any other comments?
Well, it sounds like he changed his way of following that law also. So it sounds like they would ridicule ordinarily someone who was gleaning, and so the pressure there, plus they would do a better job of harvesting, because he gave different instructions.
Yes, he went extra miles for her. Is that what
but
you
it
mean?
It seems like his usual process was getting as close to the law's definition as he could to and still keep it.
It could well be. Which may be part of the romance that we sense here, I think, is what you're saying.
So as a rich man, he could certainly afford to let the people have the meeting. That was a small part of the harvest.
He extends, I guess the generosity of the man is extended, is demonstrated in the way he does deliberately extra things. Yeah. Okay, now time is moving along pretty fast, and I guess I'd like to ask you to think a little bit about how God acts in this story. As someone said, God here is in the shadows. And yet, that same person has said God is the main actor in the story. Now, how do you put those two things together? How do you relate the ways of God in this story? Is there any parting of the Red Sea? Is there any deliverance of Jerusalem from the army of Sennacherib? Are there any dramatic miracles and interventions of God in human history here?
Commit your plans to the Lord and he will bring it to pass. You sort of have this fulfillment.
Okay. Someone has said that there are about seven prayers, or at least however many prayers and invocations to God there are, every single one of them is answered. So you're saying there are things in our life that we can't control, but commit them to God, and however it turns out, we receive that from his hand. Okay. But how does it work out? I mean, how does God do this?
He uses people,
yes. Can you think of some examples how he does? Okay, that's an insightful, thoughtful suggestion. That Ruth herself, Naomi, is at a point of despair, maybe like Job. In fact, it's been suggested that her cry is very similar to the Job story. Why has God done this to me? And yet it's remarkable that she goes to God and cries to him. It's a great Old Testament complaint that she comes to him with her bitterness of soul. Yeah. Any other comments about how God works? Harold?
He's sort of a free agent in that he takes away and he gives. It doesn't seem to be in a particular box or any constrictions on him at all.
Very good. And that's really made clear in the opening scene where there's famine and there are deaths, and that is life. And sometimes one has to say, I feel bitter about that. Yes. But he also gives.
God takes misfortunes in our lives and turns them to good. He accomplishes good through the misfortunes that happen. He did not wish that the husband of Naomi would die, or that the husbands of the two daughters would die. But he, through that, caused them to go and do what he wished, and through that, they fulfilled the bringing of the heir of David, eventually. So I see God's plan being worked all the way through it.
In retrospect, we see a marvelous unfolding of God's plan, don't we? But it's interesting how it happens. It happens, as some of you have said already, through the people. Every single one of the prayers that's directed to God to do something, to have loving kindness on someone else, is then turned around in the action and is carried out by people. I've jotted down a list of these. Let me just read one or two of them to you. For example, Boaz describes the God as the God under whose wings you look for security. And yet Boaz himself is the one who takes Ruth under his wings. Another one, Naomi makes a bitter complaint and says, the Lord has returned me empty. And then later on in chapter 3, verse 17, it's Boaz who says, I won't send Ruth home empty to Naomi. And that's just the beginning, you know, sending some grain, six measures of grain. But how much fuller does Boaz literally make Naomi's arms when she takes the child to her breast, by the way, which does not mean she was the wet nurse. She was surely past that time. It just meant to the place of her affection, and nursed her probably means cared for her, nurtured for her, did what a good grandmother would do. But in any case, there her arms surely were filled and she's no longer empty. And another is, for example, the Lord is implored to do Chesed, to do mercy for the two women, and blessed for having not forsaken them. And then it turns out that the two women, and especially Ruth, are the ones who carry out this mercy to Naomi. So if I would put it very simply, we could say the way God acts in this story is through people. Another
unlikely people,
everyday people. Question, another early preparation for Christmas, incarnational theology, I think, God acting in human life, in humble circumstances, through humble people, and doing his cheseth, his loving kindness, this kindness that we pray about when we say, oh, give thanks unto the Lord for his mercy, that's that cheseth, or kindness endures forever.
Another pre-Christmas thought, that we would expect God to come from a, that Jesus to come from a royal line, which he does not, and we would expect him to be born in very excellent surroundings, which he was not.
I'd like at this time to plug you into a book by Walter Brueggemann called The Prophetic Imagination, which Larry Rasmussen has introduced us all to. We don't have time to even look at that. But I think it would be very interesting to place Ruth right at the middle, those of you who are aware of the story, middle of a way of singing God's song when we're dependent on his mercy, which it was before Ruth, to the time when a powerful political kingdom is developed, and then the song begins to be one that is a much more, let's say, a song of power through economic control and political oppression. And Ruth is right at the midpoint, which shows us how life might be among God's people. And then, in a way, that story is picked up again in Jesus Christ. The bell is going to ring in a minute. One last word, and I think that might be a nice way to conclude our conversation, but I hope the discussion goes on. And that is that Naomi cries out bitterly in complaint against God. But at the end of the story, there are two places where we're told that the name is given, or a name, a boy is to be called. By a certain name. And that's in verse 11 and also in in 14, and may his name be renowned. It has been suggested here that the his may be God's name, but it also perhaps implies the name of the son of the couple. Boaz's name, but in any case, that the name is celebrated. And finally, when the women of the neighborhood give him a name, saying, a son has been born, the translation may really be suggesting that they celebrate his name. So the story moves from complaint to a singing of the Lord's song in a most remarkable way. Well, I hope that has enabled you to see some new things in the story, and it will enable us better to sing the Lord's song wherever we are. Thank you.